I'm Rich Eggeran. This is In the Tri-States, a review of the news of the past month. A Western Illinois community stood out among the applicants for a technology-related grant program conducted by the state of Illinois. Monmouth learned last month that we'll receive $10,000 from the inaugural Illinois Broadband Innovation Fund. More than 100 applications were submitted, just 14 winners were chosen. Monmouth Community Development Director Paul Skydema says his town was the only municipality chosen.
That's pretty exciting, and to be a municipality that's not like Chicago, but a little bitty town of 9,400 people in the cornfields, it's a great honor, and we're looking forward to delivering some good work and sharing it.
Skydema says the city will partner with others to create the Warren County Virtual Museum. He believes it will primarily appeal to current and past residents, but it can also be used to market the city and the county. It could include photos of artifacts, documents, video snippets, and more. McDonough County's only National Historic District now includes a museum. The one-room building contains artifacts from the old Moses King Brick and Tile Works operation near Colchester. One of the artifacts is a brick signed by company founder Moses King. It's something the current owners say they stumbled across one day among the countless bricks on the grounds. The Brickyard's Tim Schroll says it was akin to coming across a needle in a haystack.
That's the Holy Grail is what that is. That is totally what it's like. I mean, we had no concept that that even existed.
Schroll says the signature was verified by comparing it to King's signature in the old tax rolls kept at the Western Illinois University Archives. The museum and the Brickyard grounds can be seen by appointment only. The Lee County Board of Supervisors held a special meeting in Weaver on October 22nd to hear from the public about Iowa Fertilizer Company's proposed plant. Public Radio's Jason Parrott was there and has the details.
More than 120 people filled a multi-purpose room in the Grace Bible Church for the 90-minute meeting. The supervisor spent the first 30 minutes answering questions submitted by residents about 2 weeks ago. The rest of the time was devoted to audience questions and/or comments. More than 20 people used the opportunity to quiz the supervisors on a wide range of topics, including noise and air pollution, emergency response, and water usage. Supervisor Gary Folio says the board did the best it could to answer the questions.
We want to get all the questions answered. I mean, that's our prerogative. I mean, that's what we intend to do.
Kristen Brookheiser of Weaver was not satisfied with the meeting.
I'm not confident with the answer of air pollution not affecting my home, as well as noise. Can I leave my windows open at night? What kind of odor with the predominantly southerly winds will be blowing from that plant directly to my home? Those answers have not been given to me.
The supervisors took no action after the meeting, nor did they give any indication that another meeting would be held in regards to the $1.4 billion fertilizer plant. I'm Jason Parrott.
There is little hope left for the Jacksonville Developmental Center after a state board voted on October 30th in favor of shutting it down. Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky has the story.
The vote by the panel that oversees state health facilities comes as a disappointment to Republican State Representative Jim Watson, who's been fighting to keep the institution open. He sees it as Governor Pat Quinn not caring about downstate.
I feel like I don't know where we can turn from here. Losing that many jobs is the equivalent of the city of Chicago losing 60,000 jobs. 60,000.
Even before the vote, Quinn's administration has been steadily moving the developmentally disabled residents out of the JDC. Many are going to smaller group homes, a lifestyle some advocates say is much better than a large institution. But other advocates say those with severe disabilities need the particular 24-hour care an institution provides. The panel's 6-1 vote goes against the recommendation of the board's professional staff, which had recommended keeping Jacksonville open. Quinn's aiming to close the JDC by November 21st. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
A new study from Western Illinois University shows bugs might not always be a bad thing for farmers. Public Radio's James Needham filed this report last month.
It's possible some mulching pests could ultimately do more good than harm to crops by helping them pull through hardships like this year's drought. WIU biologist Richard Musser found the saliva of hornworms can turn on frost and drought-resistant genes in plants. He says that could have big implications for the agricultural community.
If we can figure out what is really involved in protecting plants from those drought response, you know, turn on those drought responses earlier, that plant might be able to deal with less water.
Musser's findings will be published in the Journal of Chemical Ecology this month. His latest study is a follow-up to an earlier discovery that some plants, including tomatoes, will actually call for help when attacked by herbivores such as caterpillars. The SOS attracts insect predators that eat caterpillars. Musser called the phenomenon screaming tomato plants. I'm James Needham.
When Congress recessed for the election season without passing a new farm bill, many observers thought farmers would demand explanations as campaign trails blazed through small towns. In conjunction with Harvest Public Media, Public Radio's Amy Mayer has this look at how the farm bill is playing this election season in Iowa.
Hi, Raisin.
Good, how are you?
At the Uptown Cafe in Jefferson, Iowa, Mike Holden extends a hearty greeting to another Greene County farmer. Holden runs a beef, corn, and soybean farm 10 miles away in Scranton. Like many other farmers, Holden says he cares about the farm bill, especially its crop insurance program.
This year is a prime example of why we have to have that safety net. When you had drought from the sandhills of Nebraska to the eastern edge of Ohio down to northern Texas and everywhere in between.
This year, he'll vote in the tight election fight between Republican incumbent Representative Steve King and former Iowa First Lady Kristi Vilsack, a Democrat. It's one of the many competitive races across the Midwest that will help determine who controls Congress, and its farm country setting could have given the farm bill prime billing. Since Republican House leaders stalled the farm bill last summer, many observers thought campaigning Democrats would pressure incumbent Republicans for an explanation.
To me, the big surprise about the farm bill is that the Democrats have actually not made more of a case for the farm bill and essentially made that more part of their campaign in criticizing Republicans, who are the ones who have blocked it.
That's Iowa State University political science professor Stefan Schmidt. Weeks ago, he thought the farm bill would really matter in certain tight races. In North Dakota, Nebraska, and Missouri, House Republicans face tough competition for re-election or for Senate seats. But with election season reaching its final stage, the candidates and voters largely have other priorities. To be sure, here in Iowa, it's almost impossible not to talk about ag on the campaign trail. But when Vilsack and King have, it's been largely about politics, not policy. Vilsack has criticized King for not publicly pressuring the House leadership to get the farm bill passed.
And he serves on the Agriculture Committee, and I think that sends a strong message to rural Iowa and to the people of his district that he isn't a leader.
But King dismissively brushes off her attacks.
Where this has gone is it's gotten intensely more and more political. And something that people need to understand is it's not Republicans holding up this bill. Republicans want to get a good farm bill.
The thing is, elections are a numbers game. This year's divisive presidential election is expected to boost turnout. But Schmidt says there just aren't enough farmers anymore to drive the agenda, even in the Midwest. Plus, it seems that everywhere, concerns about jobs, the so-called fiscal cliff, and social issues are overshadowing farm policy. In Missouri, for instance, where current House Republican Todd Akin is challenging Democratic incumbent Senator Claire McCaskill, ag issues should be important. But the campaign has largely centered on social issues and personal attacks. Throughout farm country, Schmidt says, campaign strategists choose carefully what to focus on. And apparently, there's not much to gain from talking about the farm bill.
Or else they just overlooked it because there are other issues that are more capturing the attention of the media and the public.
How are you doing, sir?
And back at the Uptown Cafe, well, Farmer Holden says that's largely been true in Greene County.
I don't think the farm bill will end up being an issue in the election. Should it be here, it certainly should be a part of it.
Even if it's not on voters' minds when they cast their ballots, the future of the farm bill will be determined by the decisions they make at the polls. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Yeah. Every time we get into our vehicles, our goal is to make it from point A to point B. We don't really worry about the conditions of the gravel roads or paved streets we travel unless we blow a tire or chip a windshield. The Missouri Department of Transportation is worried drivers will soon pay more attention to its roads because of a lack of money to properly maintain them. A special Blue Ribbon Committee is now trying to prevent that from happening. Public Radio's Jason Parrott filed this story last month.
2012 has been a pretty good year for transportation improvements in northeast Missouri. A new Route 16 bridge now spans Sugar Creek in Lewis County. Deanne Turner of rural Lewis County says with the bridge being several feet wider, it is much safer.
So this will make it very nice. And plus, my husband and my father-in-law, they farm. They use the elevators on this side, so this will make it safer for them, and that's really nice, too.
In Cahokia, the Missouri Department of Transportation, or MoDOT, partnered with the city in the construction of two new downtown sidewalks. Mayor Wayne Bloom says the new sidewalks are welcome sights.
It makes it nicer appearing, basically. Makes it easier for handicapped people to get up here.
Bloom says Cahokia would like to replace its two remaining downtown sidewalks. Area engineer Amy Crawford says whether MoDOT will be able to help with a project like that remains to be seen.
You know, we're going to do the best we can with what we have, and we're going to make the most of the money that we have available. But until something changes on the funding outlook at the state level, but also at the federal level, you know, it's not just a state problem. Until then, you know, these projects, you're not going to see as many as you've seen in the last few years.
The uncertainty Crawford describes is what MoDOT has called the financial cliff. Chief Financial Officer Roberta Broker says the agency's budget will shrink from roughly $1.2 billion to $600 million next year. She says many factors are contributing to the reduction, starting with high gasoline prices keeping people out of their vehicles.
When it flirts with $3.50 or $4, people begin to drive less. The other thing that happens is that at a national level, we have a push towards increasing the fuel efficiency of vehicles.
Broker says another problem is Missouri's gasoline tax. She says it has not been increased in 20 years, so revenue has not kept up with inflation or the rising cost of construction. Broker made her comments to the Blue Ribbon Citizens Committee on Missouri's transportation needs during its meeting in Hannibal. The 22-member panel is a mix of public and private citizens with direct connections to transportation in Missouri. It will prepare a report on the state's transportation needs for the legislature. Former House Speaker Rod Jetton is serving as co-chair of the committee. He says a recently completed outline covers a wide range of topics, including methods for increasing revenue.
People talked about sales tax, they talked about fuel tax, they talked about vehicle miles traveled. There were some very innovative different ideas on fees and licensing and different ways to raise money to help meet the looming shortfall that's going to happen with our highway and transportation funding.
MoDOT estimates a 1 cent increase in the gasoline tax would generate $30 million, while a similar sales tax hike would bring in $700 million each year. Jetton says the agency has been very proactive as it faces the loss in funding. MoDOT has cut hundreds of jobs, closed offices, and sold equipment, so Jetton sees this report as an educational alarm for Missouri residents.
Missourians, usually, if they felt like they could trust that you were going to build the project, they invested in infrastructure and transportation because they know, you know, it does improve the economy, it adds jobs, it brings in companies and tracks them to our state, as well as, maybe most important, you know your kids and your family's going to be safer, you know, traveling out and about on the roads and highways.
Jetton says the committee would like to complete its report by Thanksgiving. Area engineer Amy Crawford says until a solution to MoDOT's funding situation is reached, her office will simply focus on repairs for next year.
Mostly we're going to be focused on maintenance and maintaining the system that we have. There won't be expansion projects in the foreseeable future.
That is unless Missouri residents are willing to reach into their pocketbooks to make sure they can travel from point A to point B without worrying about the road they're on. I'm Jason Parrott.
A pair of ribbon-cutting ceremonies late in the month celebrated the completion of major projects in western Illinois. In Galesburg, amid much hoopla, the city dedicated and opened the West Main Street overpass on October 26th. The project cost more than $16 million. The vast majority of that came from the state, so Governor Pat Quinn took part in the ceremony. and pointing out the overpass will especially benefit future generations, Quinn quoted Galesburg native Carl Sandburg,
who once said, "The birth of a baby is God's opinion that the world should go on." Sometimes when we make sacrifices today and we have to pay for things, but those things make a difference for our children tomorrow.
The bridge is officially called the Donald Moffett Overpass in honor of the Republican state representative who helped make it possible. Moffett chose to paraphrase from his favorite children's book, The Little Engine That Could.
That little engine kept saying, "I think I can, I think I can, I think I can." And then as it got over the top and started down, it said, "I thought I could, I thought I could." We've got one more line to add to our story here in Galesburg. And it's, "We did it. We did it." Okay, we did it. It's here.
This is the first of three overpasses planned for Galesburg. The others are on East Main Street and Seminary Street. The other big ribbon cutting in the region took place a few days later, on October 29th, to celebrate the reopening of the road that circumnavigates Argyle Lake near Colchester. Portions of the road were washed out by a flash flood in late June 2007, which forced the state to close half the park. Illinois Department of Natural Resources Director Mark Miller took part in the ceremony. Miller says he enjoys driving the road.
I think that this is one of the prettiest drives in any of our state parks. It's a bit of a challenging road, which makes it kind of fun, too. You got to keep your hands at 10 and 2 and your eyes on the road. But it's a beautiful drive.
Miller says the project cost $5 million. It also included installation of wider box culverts, new pads at the Big Oak Campground, and new parking spots. A federal lawmaker says a public-private partnership is working well for both sides in southeast Iowa. Public Radio's Jason Parrott explains in this story from October 18th.
BNSF Railway's original swing-span railroad bridge across the Mississippi River in Burlington was built in 1868 and renovated in 1893. It's been replaced by a 2,100-foot-long structure that features a lift span which elevates to accommodate boats or barges. The new bridge cost about $150 million. BNSF and the federal government basically split the cost. Iowa U.S. Senator Tom Harkin says public-private partnerships like this are crucial.
Creates new jobs, creates more economic activity, makes us more competitive in global markets. So it's a win-win for both public and private sector.
BNSF Railway CEO Matt Rose says the idea of replacing the bridge dates back to 1991 after the U.S. Coast Guard deemed it a hazard to river traffic. He says the new bridge will allow cross-country transportation for decades to come.
This bridge will handle about 40 trains a day, two Amtrak trains. Our expectation is that with the quality of construction, that this bridge ought to be able to go for 150 to 200 years.
Rose says the bridge will also open and close much more quickly, decreasing the wait time for train traffic. More than 200 people turned out to the Port of Burlington for the dedication of the new bridge. I'm Jason Parrott.
The Macomb Public Library building is more than 100 years old. The president of the library board says it can last many more years if some changes are made. The library announced on October 5th it's launching a capital campaign to build a two-story addition. The state will pay 75% of the cost if nearly $800,000 is raised locally to cover the rest of the price tag. There's another catch, too. The money must be raised by the end of June. Library Board President George Wanamaker says the addition will provide more space for just about everything the library does.
We have a small children's library, and we have programs that often involve as many as 400 kids, and fitting them in is just virtual impossibility. We've had to turn kids away. We have five computers, and we could use three or four times that many. The public can come and use a computer to get on and check their internet or check their email or play games or do research, and we only have five of them. We need a lot more. We have room for about 55,000 books, and we've got them stored in closets. We've got turned closets into rooms, and we just need more space for books. We also need space for doing the work that goes on in a library, bringing books in and getting them processed so they can be loaned out. loaning them out and taking them back, all of the things that it takes to make a library run.
Why would you tell someone a library remains important in this day of tablets and computers and other ways of reading things?
Well, library is important not just for the books. It's a focal point in a community. And when they evaluate community life, one of the things they check into is what type of library you have and what type of services it provides. And very few large corporations will come to a town that doesn't have a reasonably good library. That's one of the things they look at when they're evaluating the town. So a library is important far and beyond the fact that we loan books. But we also are going to provide areas for different segments of our population here in Macomb to come for programs, for reading programs, to come in and use technology that they don't have at home, get on the internet. So it's not just the books that you have. And I've heard people say that a library is going out. If you look in history all the way back to pre-history times, there have been libraries. The Library of Hammurabi was several thousand years before Christ, and if they've persevered for 5,000 years, it's my guess they're going to persevere for at least another 100 or 200 years, which would probably be the life of the library that we are building. This library is 100 years old. If we do this, we think we're extending the life probably another 100 years or more.
Macomb Library Board President George Wanamaker says the state is ready to send Macomb the money as soon as the local match is raised. Meanwhile, Rushville already has the matching money in hand to receive a state grant for building a new library. The $400,000 comes from a bequest from Mardell Hinner. As a result of having that money, the city will receive a $1.2 million state grant. Library Director Charlene Copeland says the current two-story building will be replaced by a single-story library.
It makes it more accessible for everybody, just makes it easier to run the library so that we're not on two floors, because we're usually just two at a time at the library staff-wise.
Copeland says the current building is nearly 100 years old and cramped. The new library will be nearly triple the size. It'll be built at the corner of Mason and Maple. The city bought the land last year. Once upon a time, browsing through a book or record store was one of life's simple pleasures. Now, many people prefer to browse online, putting those stores on the endangered species list. However, they're not yet extinct. I talked to a few small-town book and record store owners to find out what they're doing to keep the doors open and filed this report on the first day of October. When you walk into Stone Alley Books in Galesburg, there's a good chance you'll be greeted by the owner.
My name is Ben Stomberg. Everybody just calls me Stone.
Stone comes across as anything but bookish. He's a big guy with a personality to match, and he wants the store to reflect that.
We're louder than a library and a little bit more colorful, and we've got quite the cast of freaks and geeks on occasion, but that's all part of the enjoyment factor.
Stone worked in radio for a number of years. He also sold comic books online. When the Walden Bookstore in Galesburg closed, Stone got a loan and a grant from the city and set up shop on Seminary Street.
I didn't really enjoy selling stuff as much online as I do running a store. I had run a small music store back in the 90s before I got into radio, and like that was kind of something that I enjoyed doing, was running the shop. And since we didn't have a bookstore in the town, I felt like it was something that like we kind of nearly needed as a community.
Stone's business strategy emphasizes diversity. The store sells new and used books, as well as comics and vinyl records. You can get coffee and Wi-Fi service there. Stone does special orders and tries to hunt down books that people have trouble finding. He encourages folks to make an afternoon out of browsing. He wants people to hang out at Stone Alley. There's even a group that comes in every week to play Scrabble. Stone thinks he's being helped by a change in shoppers' attitudes. For one thing, more are becoming aware of the impact of shopping local.
Every dollar you spend, if you spend it at a local business, a local restaurant, a family-owned mechanic, whatever, 70 cents out of that dollar will stay in your community. If you spend that same dollar at a chain or a big box store, roughly 30 to 35 cents out of that dollar stays in your community.
So, after 3 years in business, how's he doing?
The lights are on and the doors are open, which is kind of the best you can hope for in this economy.
Well, fly around my pretty little list, fly around my daisy.
Another bookstore trying to create a sense of community is New Copperfields Book Service on Macomb's Courthouse Square. It holds events such as Fine Art Fridays to showcase local artists and Saturday afternoon Hootenannies to showcase local musicians. Owner Linda Cox says it's all about community. The bookshelves reflect that. Instead of heavily stocking national bestsellers, New Copperfields emphasizes local and regional authors. The store also holds regular book signings with those writers. In addition, Cox listens to what her customers say they want. She tries to offer stuff you cannot find in a big box store.
It's community. It's all about community. The more I read about how other independents are staying alive, and some of them are growing, it's because they're servicing and finding a need and filling needs in communities.
Cox says her main source of income is from a farm she owns, but the bookstore is her labor of love. However, she would not still be in business if customers did not come in on a regular basis and buy books.
This community should not be able to support an independent bookstore, but because of the response of this community, we're able to be here. That's awesome.
Just keep chugging on.
Another store that keeps on trucking is Capitol Music. Eric Matthews has owned the store in Canton for nearly 25 years and one in Macomb for about 10. Matthews says he's changed with the times in order to stay in business. In addition to CDs, he's sold shoes, skateboards, ball caps, and more. Today, movies and video games sell just as well as the music. He also started selling guitars after a customer requested he do so. Matthew says it's important for customers to speak up and let them know what they want.
People sometimes come in and wander and won't ask and won't tell us what they want. I wish they'd tell us because I'd love to order it for them or I'd love to get it and carry it because they don't realize how hard it is for a small store like us to know what we need, what we should carry.
Matthew says he sold phenomenal amounts of roller hockey gear 1 year based on customer requests. He's also had to rely on used CD sales to carry him through. He says the store makes little money on new CDs. Matthew says after all these years, he's not a rich man, but he is doing okay.
I think we just keep doing what we're doing, and I hate to say roll with the changes, not to quote REO Speedwagon, but I think we just have to kind of go and just see where it takes us, you know, because It's been a unique ride the last 25 years. First half were awesome. Second half's been a little tougher. But yeah, so I think we're here for the duration, yes.
What a long, strange trip it's been, though.
There you go. Yeah, if we're going to quote song titles, yeah.
What a long, strange trip it's been.
It's been a long, strange trip for Matthews and Stone and Cox, but they plan to keep on trucking. As long as customers keep making an effort to tell them what they want and use their purchasing power to shop local, with stores devoted to creating a sense of community. Well, that concludes In the Tri-States. Thanks to Jason Parrott, James Needham, Amy Mayer, and Amanda Vinicky for their contributions. For Tri-States Public Radio News, I'm Rich Hugger.